This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, December 2nd. I'm Dave Benninger, and we are glad to have you on board as always. Coming up this week, we'll get reaction on yesterday's Local Boundary Commission decision and what's next for annexations of the Nooshigak Bay.
I can't imagine the legislature, you know, limiting a community's ability to support itself. So I feel pretty positive once everything gets to Juneau that we shouldn't have issues there.
Plus, even in the dark days of winter, solar power is proving its merit over a Naknek.
Our members are going to end up saving money for the electricity that has been produced by the solar panels. It goes straight into our grid, and it's distributed to our members.
We'll visit with one of the many artists getting ready for this weekend's Christmas Bazaar in Dillingham.
You see how many people go to the Christmas Bazaar and how warm their feelings are for you. People come up and smile at you, and they don't even know what you're selling yet.
And retiring Superior Court Judge Pat Douglas joins us for our Friday conversation.
Yeah, this is actually my third time to retire, and I just had my 67th birthday. I am too old. I'm done.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of this week's news. The state's Local Boundary Commission voted Thursday to advance two petitions to annex part of the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District. Both Manicotic and Dillingham are asking to bring all or a portion of the waters into their city limits for the purpose of collecting a fish tax. An LBC staff report had recommended voting both petitions down, but after 3 days of public testimony, the commissioners voted to adopt both with amendments. The set net beaches on the east side of the Nooshigak Bay were excluded from Dillingham's requested territory and the Igooshik section given to Manicotic. Despite the votes to move the petitions forward, Commissioner John Harrington said he was not pleased.
I think we made serious mistakes today. First of all, we dealt with a regional resource, which in fact, in my sense, it's a state resource, and we delegated it to several individual places, which I have some problem with. And ever since we did this initially, I have come around to believe that this whole annexation of huge sections of water is best left in boroughs.
Others on the LBC said they felt the petitions were in the best interest of the communities and the state. Commissioner Robert Hart-Charik said he felt annexation and borough formation in the Dillingham census area could move forward at the same time.
The only comment I have is that even though we allocated resources or bodies of water that contain resources, those actions do not preclude the formation of a borough in some time in the probably distant future.
The LBC directed their staff to set the amended boundaries, and a final vote will not be taken for another several weeks. If approved, then the petitions go to the state legislature. If lawmakers do not disapprove, Manicotic and Dillingham will claim their new territory early next year and can levy a raw fish tax by next season. The northernmost community in the United States restored its traditional indigenous name on December 1st. Formerly Barrow voters in October voted by a margin of 6 to make the name change, pronounced here in a video on social media.
And the new name for Barrow is Utqarevik. Utqarevik.
The name change was scheduled to be fully official by December 1st, but a court order has at least temporarily delayed the implementation. A local Native corporation has sued the city, claiming the measure wasn't properly noticed to the public and alleging municipal rule violations. There's still no sign of a Palmer teenager who was reported missing more than 2 weeks ago. 16-year-old David Grunewald was by his family on November 13th after he failed to return home from a date. His car was found burned a day later. Troopers continue to ask for the public's help in the case. In Soldotna, state troopers reported finding two bodies in a burned-out vehicle down a wooded trail Sunday. Few details have been released, but troopers say they believe the remains are those of two people who were reported missing in Soldotna more than a week before they were found dead. Iditarod mushers will no longer be able to carry dogs in trailers behind their sleds. Aaron Burmeister is treasurer for the Iditarod's board of directors. He says the change came during a meeting at the end of last month.
Mainly, it clarifies that dogs will be hauled in the front sled if they're being hauled during the race. It's clarifying we're not hauling dogs in trailers for safety reasons.
Some mushers have been critical of the rule, along with another controversial change passed by the board that allows for two-way communication devices like cell phones to be carried on the trail. The new rules will be in effect for the upcoming Iditarod in March. A frigid air mass descended from the north on much of Alaska this week, sending temperatures and wind chills to their lowest spot on thermostats in more than 2 years. In Bristol Bay, temperatures of 15 below and wind chills of more than 40 below were recorded earlier this week. According to the National Weather Service, last weekend's storm system that brought blizzard-like conditions inland brought strong winds along the coast. A 99-mile-an-hour gust was recorded at False Pass Saturday, and seas of 51 feet recorded at a weather buoy in the Bering Sea. The state's seismologists confirmed this week what many in Port Hyden have felt for some time. There have been more earthquakes than usual along the Alaska Peninsula, especially near Aniakchak. Michael West calls it a swarm.
If we look back over the past 15 years or so at earthquake activity in the area of Port Hyden that's shallow in the earth, what we can say is that the vast majority of those, meaning more than half of those, have occurred thus far in 2016.
The swarm began with a 6.2 magnitude quake last April. West says this tectonic activity can stop abruptly, but often just fades away. And Alaska's now former Attorney General Craig Richards has a new job. He announced he'll be the new general counsel for the Bering Straits Native Corporation and says he's looking forward to working with the Nome region.
Really what convinced me that it was the right place for me was just meeting everyone and seeing what a good rapport and a good team environment they have and the ability to help out the Nome region.
Richards had two contracts with the state after he abruptly resigned as attorney general last June. The first was for $50,000 to consult the state on oil and gas issues. Richards' second contract was for $10,000 to advise on fiscal and other issues. Richards' work with the state has ended. He declined to say what his new position will pay. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. It was a rare and unexpected move that the Local Boundary Commission voted to advance both Manicotic and Dillingham's annexation petitions Thursday. Both cities hope to take waters of the Nooshigak Bay into their city limits for the purpose of collecting a raw fish tax. The complicated proposals have met with much resistance, including from state staffers who said it was unworkable, but the commissioners felt otherwise. I caught up with Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby just after yesterday's hearing wrapped up to get her reaction. Mayor Ruby, good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, Dave. Thanks.
First of all, it's been a long week of rich public testimony.
It has been a very long week, and actually it's been a very long year.
A couple of years, actually.
I was just thinking about it today. It's probably been, you know, I think the city council started this back in 2009, 2010, so... It has been a long and laborious process.
Well, the process is satisfying to watch, just from my perspective, because it allowed everyone to get a voice in and to get a—I mean, this thing was just ripped apart and looked at with a microscope at the fibers of it and argued intensely, and it led up to today's decisional hearing. What is your initial reaction so far? I know you don't want to speak on behalf of the council till they've digested, but what's your reaction?
Well, I think so far it's positive. I think that the LBC did what they could to try to give both communities, you know, something for the future. And so I think it's positive. I think part of it is it's just been such a long 3 days that it will take some time to digest everything that's happened. But I think the fact that they approved our petition, even with amendments, demonstrated that they, you know, saw the merits of, you know, Dillingham's need to grow and the fact that we're providing services and so on.
You've probably had to answer many times about this, but I'll ask you again. There were concerns raised by a number of people, not just petitioners, but folks from neighboring villages and communities. They say it's not fair. Dillingham shouldn't get this lion's share of this regional resource. How do you respond?
Well, the same way we did the last few days, that we're providing services, we're supporting the region, and we will be continuing to do that. And so we just need a way to help us pay for that. And And I think the LBC acknowledged that. I think they probably acknowledged it for both Gillingham and Manicotic by allowing us to tax, the resource that both of us are using for our, to pay for the services.
What they amended today was a bit of a confusing scheme, and I think it's going to take a little bit of time to digest what all that means. The two things that stood out to me right away was that it's going to be hard to split the drift catch along that Igushik section line, and that by excluding set netters on the east side of the Nooshigak Bay, it may create a two-tiered set net fishery out here. Are you concerned about either one of those?
Certainly, we'll have to work with the city of Manicotic on how we, implement that the tax with that boundary line running down the district. But we've worked with Manicotic on other issues, and we certainly will be able to do it in this case. And I guess I haven't had as much time to think about that the set net exclusion since that just came up during this LBC hearing, and we still haven't seen the meets and bounds boundaries on those as yet. The LBC did clarify that that's something that'll be brought back to them here in a few weeks. So I think it's just all a matter of implementation. We'll have to figure out how it works.
In your judgment, do you think that the city of Dillingham will be recollecting a 2.5% fish tax by next fishing season?
Yeah, I think so, and I would hope so. I think that the work that we did in the petition is enough to demonstrate the need, and especially with the state of Alaska and the position that it's in now, I can't imagine the legislature limiting a community's ability to support itself. So I feel pretty positive once everything gets to Juneau that we shouldn't have issues there.
Following today's hearing, are we any closer to a Dillingham census area borough? Do you think that's ever possible? Has it ever been possible? Will this push it closer to being possible? Tear us apart further as communities? What's your sense?
Well, I think at least from Dillingham's perspective, there is a potential. It's out there. When that will happen, we don't know. Some of the reasons to have a borough still exist, and that is, resource development and trying to put us in a position to influence, the resource development in our area is an incentive for a borough. That still exists. It's always going to be there. When that's going to happen has been the bigger question. I think that we're probably still going to keep working on it. I think the council's intent is that they want to be there at the table when we do finally decide to take some positive action on being a borough in the future.
Alice Ruby is Dillingham's mayor, reacting here today just following the Local Boundary Commission's decisional meeting that sort of found in favor of all who wanted something.
Yeah, that's...
Sort of split the baby, I guess.
That was what I heard someone else say. Well, they really tried to make everybody happy. So
I don't know that that ever works, but we still have time. I don't think we're going to stop talking about annexation for any time soon, would be my guess. But
no, or boroughs. I think that discussion will continue.
Alice, thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave.
And we've reached out to leaders from Manicotic and Eacock for their reaction today, but have not yet heard back. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. Not a lot of sunshine this time of the year at these northern latitudes. Even when we have plenty of daylight in the summer, Bristol Bay is not known for being consistently clear and sunny skies. Nevertheless, solar power is being tested here in this region right now. It seems to be working and may be the first of more Alaska solar projects to come. KDLG's Avery Lill has more details.
Alternative energy projects dot the landscape of rural Alaska, each marking a hope of a cheaper, cleaner solution to burning diesel. Hydropower in New Halen and Chignik Lagoon has proven successful. Wind turbines in Kakanak and geothermal in Naknek have not. Ikiyagig is exploring river power, and Naknek is now turning to the sun. Capstone Solutions developed and installed what they believe is the largest solar array in Alaska, which sits in the tundra near Peterson Point. Capstone Director of Solar Development David Nickel says it was a rough road to completion.
I proposed a much larger system for the utility. I was initially turned down. The school asked if we were interested in installing that same project on the school, and we were. And then at that point, we installed it, thinking we had a path to permitting. And it turns out we didn't. And that was our mistake. That was Capstone's mistake. So then we decided to try to clear that by just offering to sell the installation to the utility, which they bought.
When Capstone ran into permitting issues with the school, they sold the array to the Naknek Electric Association.
We decided we wanted to keep this thing up there anyways and keep it installed because it would still fulfill our original purpose. And so we offered to sell it just to recoup our costs, not necessarily to make a profit. The original purpose was just to prove that it could be done in Alaska for a reasonable amount of money.
The solar array has been operating for about 2 months now, and Nickel says that it's performing better than expected.
So in 45 days, it produced about two months and 4 days of the power. And quite a bit of that was in October, which is, from our standpoint, really good. If it's doing that well in the winter, it'll do really well in the summer.
This is the first place Capstone has built a solar array in rural Alaska. Nickel sees several reasons for developing renewable energy in the region. One is offsetting the use of diesel fuel.
But the other big reason is my family homesteaded actually pretty close to Kakanak, Alaska. And, you know, working up in the fisheries in Alaska, I've been fishing in Alaska for 22 years now, I see the impact of high cost of power and heat on the villages. You know, it's too expensive to live there, or it's really expensive to live there. And so, you know, some young people leave and they don't come back and, you know, that sort of thing. And I think that the way of life that the villages have is important. And I want to make it so that they can, so people can afford to live there in, you know, relative comfort. And so I think that renewable energy is kind of a critical component of that.
He says the array in Naknek isn't big enough to make a large dent in the cost of energy for residents, but it will demonstrate that solar power is a viable option in other villages. Nancy Morris-Lyon is the president of the board of the Naknek Electric Association. She says that installing the solar array is a good move, both environmentally and economically.
A lot of it has to do with a conscious effort to reduce the carbon footprint that one's leaving behind. And the other portion of it is see if we can't find ways to ease the burden of the high cost of electrical power out in British Alaska. I think it's beneficial for Naknek Electric to be doing, and I thought it was beneficial for myself to do as a lodge owner as well.
Morris-Lyon has some previous experience with solar energy. She has a solar array installed at her lodge, and she says that it's helped her power bill for the past couple of years. And she anticipates Naknek Electric Association members will also save some money.
Our members are going to end up saving money for the electricity that has been produced by the solar panels. It goes straight into our grid, and it's distributed to our members.
If Naknek proves successful, Capstone wants to expand their solar power projects. They're in talks with three other Alaska villages, and they hope to begin construction in the spring. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Judge Pat Douglas stepped down from the bench in November after close to 5 years on the job and 13 in Dillingham. She moved to town for a temporary position in the public defender's office. When Dillingham's first Superior Court judge, Fred Teresi, retired, Douglas applied for and was hired for that job. Since taking over as judge at the end of 2011, she has presided over hundreds of civil and criminal cases, divorces, marriage, adoptions, and much more. Though we report on many of the cases, the judge normally does not comment except from the bench. I was happy to have her join me on her last day on the job to talk about her time here and that role as judge for our Friday conversation this week. I pointed out that she was rounding out a 30-year career that has taken her all over the country and all over the world.
Yeah, I had somebody once tell me when they looked at my resume, they said, well, you've either had a very interesting career with a lot of different skills and abilities, or you just can't hold a job. Well, probably a little bit of both.
Is this it? Are you retiring?
Oh, I'm done. Yeah, this is actually be my third time to retire. And I just had my 67th birthday. So I said, you know, I am too old. I'm done.
Did you know you would get to the bench someday?
No, I was never in the game plan. Never, ever, ever in the game plan. I went to law school late. I was 36. I went specifically to do civil litigation, which I did for the first 12 years of my legal career.
As you wrap up your time, and you were the second Superior Court judge out of the Dillingham Court for this area, what's your initial reflection on these past almost 4 years? 4 years? It's been 4 years?
It'll be five by the time I retire. When I was interviewed by the governor for this position, the first thing I told him is I said, well, you need to understand at my age, I'll probably just do the 5 years and retire. I think that's probably in the game. But secondly, where I always considered myself is because Judge Teresi, he was the first judge, the founding judge for this court, and so many people think of this as his court, that I said, it's going to be hard for folks to think about having a new judge. And I said, so one of the thoughts behind saying I'm committed for 5 years short term is to have a transition. We knew we were going to get a new courthouse. There were some changes being made. And I said, you know, I can fill the function of a transitional position and help ease into a new era for this community. And that's what I've kept in mind the whole time I've been on the bench, is trying to make way for hopefully younger, more agile, active member of the bar to step on. And hopefully somebody will be able to stay 15 years the way Fred did.
It's certainly a unique role. What did you find being a judge versus being a public defender? How did that change your lifestyle in town? It's a small town. You can't go very far before you interact with people in public that you've had, no doubt, not great interactions with.
Well, that was the biggest surprise. And I had been warned by other sitting judges and advised as to how to handle the situation. But when you're a public defender, you're dealing with people. You're dealing not just with your client, but your families, and all through the community. And there's a real personal involvement, both with the police and other counsel, and it's just a very. I always found it to be a very collegial experience. Quite frankly, that's one reason I ended up staying here. But when you get on the bench, it's a very isolating experience. I learned this the hard way. Because I had so many recusals being public defender the first 2 years, I was over in Palmer a lot with judges here. And a young woman that I'd known for a long time, and she didn't have any cases in front of me. And one of the first things I'd done when I took the bench was write a permanent recusal. You know, I'll never appear as a judge in front of this lawyer on any case ever. And so when I saw her, I said, well, let's have lunch. And my mentor judge, who was in Palmer, she saw us have lunch, and she took me aside, and she said, you can't do that. And I said, well, I've recused myself from all her cases. She said, people don't know that. And she said, you know, it's the appearance of impropriety, not just doing things that are not acceptable. And, so essentially, you cut yourself off from everybody and anything that you knew before, because, if you were a lawyer, your friends and acquaintances all were lawyers and former clients and people in any of the other agencies, you end up not being able to socialize at all with anybody in a small community. And that was the big shocker to me, because I never thought about that or never realized just what that meant.
Was it worth it?
That's a good question. It was worth it because at least for a cap to my professional life, because even having appeared for almost 30 years or more than 30 years in front of trial judges, I don't think I ever really appreciated the responsibility and the position that a judge was in. It's a lot harder than I ever thought it was.
Are there light moments? Are there fun moments? Are there times that you enjoyed the job that you didn't know that you would have before you took the role?
Yeah, there are things I didn't get to do as a public defender or even as a private attorney before that. The adoptions, when you see kids that have gone through the foster system and then you see these families that Our families out here, especially our foster families, are so incredible. I've never seen it like this anywhere else. But, you know, we've had foster families take in four kids at one adoption session. Mm. You know, I've had, I won't name the people, they might be embarrassed, but, you know, there's one family that they've adopted so many of their foster kids, and they always take the most difficult mm-hmm. children, the ones that in other places would be unadoptable. And the last adoption for that particular family, the husband said, "This is it. This is it." And the woman turned to him. She said, "You know that's not true." You know, so those were always very, very rewarding and very, you can't help feeling that there's really good folks in this community that I haven't ever seen anywhere else.
What about seeing some people respond to the judgments and the punishments and the rehab and turn themselves around? Is that...
That happens infrequently, but when it does happen, it is like it's the best thing. It's the cherry on top.
What were some of the difficult tasks of the job to deal with that maybe you didn't know about before you started?
Well, I'll be quite frank. I think one of the things that I have never really done to my satisfaction is in custody cases where a young couple comes in and they can't, you know, the law says this is in the best interest of the child. That's the standard. But you get these folks that come in and they're so emotionally bound up in each other and their own needs and their own dysfunctions that they can't, no matter how you address them and say, we need to figure this out so that the kids are okay. This is going to be for 18 years till these children are grown, you know, and there are some people too often for my taste that they just can't get past their own anger or resentment or whatever their emotional needs are to see what is in the best interest of the child. And there are some judges that are very good at getting people to see that. And I don't think that was one thing that I ever managed to really accomplish very well.
How have your views changed since you've been on the bench? Did you learn anything about yourself or about the law or about the community or about people?
Well, I did learn a lot. And I'm not going to address a lot of the more personal issues that I learned, but in a small community like ours, I always knew how important the criminal justice system was. And I include, you know, OCS and DJJ and probation, everybody, police, troopers, not just the courthouse, but it's a system that needs to work together. And being on the bench has really emphasized to me that if you, because there have been times where we've had a little cog fall out of the wheel, and all of those different parts of the system need to work together, or it just, you don't get a good result. Mm. And that has become very, very apparent to me sitting on the bench. One thing that has been a priority in all the different kind of legal work I've done over the years, whether it was teaching or pro bono clinics or whatever, has been I firmly believe it's not just a phrase. I firmly believe that one of the basic tenets of our Constitution is the right, the access to justice, and that's through the courts. And whether that's providing language translation or lawyers for people or whatever it is, you know, night courts so people can get to court, whatever it is, that's a basic tenet, and our system always needs to keep that in mind, that if you can't get to the courthouse, then all the laws in the world aren't going to help you. Whatever it takes for us to, people feel like they had their day in court, mm-hmm. you know, that's not just a phrase. That's, the day in court is important. Everybody needs their voice to be heard and feel like it's been heard. So that's what I hope that we've done.
Judge Pat Douglas, on your last day here on the job, and it sounds like last full day here in Dillingham. Thanks so much for the time, and congratulations to you, and good luck going forward.
Thanks, Dave.
Next week, the Judicial Council will take testimony from the public about who they think should replace Pat Douglas on the bench. We'll have more from that conversation, including her critiques of the state's criminal justice reform, known as SB 91, posted at our website and on air at a later date.
Well, tomorrow starts Dillingham's annual Christmas Bazaar. One can easily be impressed, rather wowed, by the number and talent of artists and craftsmen on display in the gym there. How many of us have forked over way more dough than we expect? This week, we were able to catch up with one local artist as she hurried to finish her wares.
My name is Aileen Walsh, and I am a potter. I've done serious pottery. I bought my kiln 10 years ago. But before that, there was always a lot of art. I did a lot of sewing, and I did a lot of artwork with sewing. And like I said, the paper mache, if you can't afford pottery, you do paper mache because you don't have the big expensive equipment. I don't think an artist can do what they do without support. You have to have somebody that says, encourages you and says, you're doing a good thing. You're doing, you know, and that's the big one. If you want to look at Dillingham, for example, they are so incredibly supportive of the arts. You know, you see how many people go to the Christmas Bazaar and how warm their feelings are for you. You know, people come up and smile at you and they don't even know what you're selling yet, you know, and it's just that they're willing to pay money because they like your art. It doesn't get any better than that. This is all that's ready for the bazaar. So a few little murals. This is geranium. Wild geranium, actually. And this is Pat's framing. And if you notice, most everything has the same theme. This is Bristol Bay, you know, there's salmon. So, and these are what sell. And then every once in a while I get, you know, where I don't feel like doing a salmon, so then I play. And I do something a little different, experiment a little bit. And some of the experiments work and some of them don't. For the bazaar, I always have some little things because invariably a little kid will come up, his hands are all full of that sticky cottony, you know, stuff, and he has a dollar in his hand. He wants to buy something for his mom. When people look at pottery, they'll look around, they might, you know, like look at this, they might look at a price or something, but eventually they'll hold it, they'll look at it, they'll think it, and they hold it to their heart. I'm not kidding you. And I go, they're buying that. Because it's so personal to them, more than some other things, you know. They're gonna use it maybe to eat out of or to have their favorite stuff in, but it becomes theirs. My favorite, and I've had a hard time admitting this, but I like the wheel the best. The clay is just, when I first started, and I wasn't very good at it, right? And it was, the clay decided what it wanted to be way more than what I wanted it to be. Of course, now we're kind of going towards the other side, but that is my favorite part. You can't count the one where you're handing it to a customer, because that's like the ultimate, you know, somebody has said, yes, you are worthy.
That's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. Send feedback and story ideas, song, poetry, and prose. Welcome to Dave at kdlg.org. My thanks to Avery Lill for her help this week. We'll look for those of you who can make it at this weekend's Christmas Bazaar. Have a great week. We hope to see you back here next Friday.